This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Just a bandwagon.
Oh, you know. Uh-oh.
And I'm like
you are.
What are you talking about? That's totally me.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming our special guest for this week, the Braden Holtby of Education Reform, Tim Daly. Tim, welcome.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
I'm not sure if I said that name right. Holtby, the goalie for the Washington Capitals. Tim, you're from Chicago, and you're used to having, you know, championship teams in various sports.
We've had many a Blackhawks parade the last couple of years.
Yeah, we have not had a championship in this city in a long, long time, and the Caps have never won the Stanley Cup, and they are up 3-1, and Washington's excited.
I'm excited. That's great news. I had no idea.
Yeah, well, you're not paying attention.
Game
What's
four
going
tonight
on?
In town.
Game five is in Vegas on Thursday.
Okay.
So check it out. Root for the Caps. Yeah. You know, everyone likes, you know, Trump calls it a swamp, but you know, for hockey, what? It's like a frozen swamp. So then it's okay. But
you're getting very, very ahead of yourselves. And if they lose, like DC will be in stitches.
And welcome to my co-host, Alyssa Schwenk.
Already here. But yes, I'm TJ What's-His-Face who rode the Metro. That's my new favorite Caps player.
There was a hockey player who had to ride who rode the Metro to the game, which is awesome.
Yes,
I love that.
Even though plated khakis, but anyways.
All right. And of course, not like the Metro is reliable. And so
I'm sure he left like 3 hours early just to make sure. And he apparently didn't have enough change, but a fan helped him out.
Are you serious?
That's
hilarious. That's awesome.
He like did not have enough on his card to make it all the way in. I'm loving everything about this story. Cool.
That is awesome. Well, hey, Tim is a founding partner of Ed Navigator. We're going to let Tim tell us about that. He is also the former president of TNTP. Tim has done all kinds of awesome stuff in his career, and we're so excited to have you here on the show, Tim.
Thanks for having me.
And now it's time for Ed Reform Update. So tell us about Ed Navigator. It's, I think, a super cool organization, but I always find a lot of people don't know what it is. You are working out there kind of quietly.
We are, yeah.
Let's fix that. Let's change that.
There's two things. So the first thing is we help parents navigate school for their kids. And we do that regardless of the kid's age. So we have parents of pre-K children all the way up through post-secondary. Uh-huh. We also help adults navigate their own educational needs. And we do it by connecting them with navigators who are knowledgeable experts who have worked in the field of education and understand how to present information and choices to families in a way that they can digest and kind of serve as almost their, I don't know, strategic advisor for the educational process.
I mean, this is super retail. Right.
Super
I mean,
retail.
Right. I mean, if you think about greatschools.net is sort of wholesale.
That's right.
You know, half of all parents go there once a year to check out stuff about schools. This is real people trained to work kind of basically one-on-one.
Correct.
With parents.
And much of it in person. So the second part of it is that we work with employers. So employers make this available as a benefit to their employees, especially hourly workers. And the navigators pay visits to the work sites. So they meet with folks before work, after work, or on a break. So many times they could be virtual, they could be a phone call, but sometimes it's sitting across from somebody in the break room.
Super cool. Working in New Orleans and Boston right now. I imagine other cities might be interested. They should get in touch with you. Right?
They should.
All right. So one of the things that you have done is as you've been working closely with families and listening to their needs and their interests and how they view schools, you noticed that there was a certain group of kids who were not being well served. And you wrote up a report about that. And it's a topic that's near and dear to our heart. It's about high achieving, low income kids. Tell us what you've learned about them.
The first thing we learned is that there are lots of them. So I think oftentimes when we talk about educational trends, there's this assumption that income and achievement correlate perfectly. And so therefore, all high income kids must be high achieving and all low income kids must be low achieving. But there's a significant number of kids in the New Orleans area and across Louisiana that are doing really well. And it's not a few hundred, it's thousands of them. Yeah. The second thing is that it doesn't matter how you measure it. You could measure it based on how well they perform on state tests. And there are kids that perform at the very top of that range. Mm-hmm. It could be that they have incredibly good grades or they qualified for gifted and talented programs, or that they, you know, went to high school and were able to pass AP courses despite, you know, their school not having the level of instruction that you might associate with being ready to attempt those types of classes. There are students that are doing really, really well.
Yeah. And these are kids that so many people care about. They say,
that's
okay,
right.
We feel bad and worse that there's not more low-income kids on elite college campuses.
Right.
You know, we all understand that we want to have the ranks of, right. you know, academia and the military and
right.
government and business to be diverse like right. our society. So this all seems like a good news story. Here's these yeah. kids. They're low-income, many of them kids of color, and they're doing great. So what's the problem?
In theory, it's all positive story. And also, in theory, students that meet this description are an enormous priority. But in reality, what we noticed is that even when students were doing very well, they seem to face obstacles on the horizon mm-hmm. that would make it difficult for them to remain high performers for the long term. Mm-hmm. And in the report, we tried to describe some of those so people get a very detailed sense of not only exactly how this plays out, but how sometimes the simplistic solutions that we might initially suggest are probably not adequate to the challenge.
Like what?
So I'll give you an example of one of the students that we describe in the report is named D'Anthony. He's a fourth grader. Mm-hmm. And the first time he took the state test in third grade, he got the highest possible category score in all four wow. tests, which almost never happens for any student in Louisiana. He's a young African-American boy. So this is like we are desperate to have greater achievement among students like D'Anthony. And his parents both work in the hotel industry and are hourly workers, so they're very much our target audience. So, you know, what's the problem? He goes to a traditional public school just outside New Orleans and had been in a charter school previously. But in all the years that he'd been in school, nobody had ever had a single conversation with his parents about him potentially being sort of an advanced student or mm-hmm. maybe qualifying for a magnet program or mm-hmm. Special services. They'd never heard anything. What they had heard is school comes easily to him. And they had internalized, basically, D'Anthony is doing great. We don't have to worry about him. Mm-hmm. Their older son, 2 years older in sixth grade, has special needs. And part of the reason the boys had moved around schools is because he wasn't served very well. Even though he's 2 years older, D'Anthony reads better than his mm-hmm. older brother does. They worry about him a lot. And they worry about what placement he's going to be in. They worry about his accommodations. And the first thing that people say is, well, if he's doing so well, his parish runs a magnet program. Why doesn't he go to one of the schools where he would be doing on grade level work? But there's no way his brother would qualify for one thing. And the parents don't want the boys to be separated. Yep. Second complication is the admissions process for those magnet programs starts in kindergarten. D'Anthony's in fourth grade. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what he scores on the test. There's virtually zero chance that he's going to get admitted because there are so many families that are trying for a handful of seats that are available. And the school that he attends now basically offers no programming whatsoever for students that are ahead of grade level. Mm-hmm. And in his school, maybe 15% of kids are on grade level. He's two grade levels ahead of where his grade is. Mm-hmm. So very little of what he encounters in the course of a day is consistent with his ability. And this year, we started to hear some whispers and concerns about behavior and talking mm-hmm. back, kind of minor stuff, but stuff that's typical for a kid who's bored in the classroom. Mm-hmm. To go back to the question of simplistic solutions, some folks hear his situation and say, well, he needs more school choice. Mm. But there's already is school choice in his parish to some degree. And he'd been in Orleans Parish where he has mm-hmm. universal school choice. Neither of those worked well for him. The second thing that people say is, well, his school needs more resources to serve kids like him. But there aren't that many other kids at his school yeah. that are like him. So it's difficult to say, let's start a program at his school mm-hmm. for students who are academically advanced because it may not be the best use of resources for the whole. So his individual circumstance is not an easy one to resolve. Mm-hmm.
Now, some of the gifted and talented folks maybe would say, well, then acceleration is something we should consider, right? That he should be allowed to move up to the fifth or the sixth grade, you know, and that there's good research and evidence that even though people forever have been worried about, well, do those kids do okay socially? Are right. they, you know, that the benefits for most kids outweigh the negatives. But there's huge ideological resistance to that in most schools. Educators just have this bias against it, right? But that might be the kind of option. But no, but it points out, look, you know, and even affluent parents of gifted and talented kids or advanced kids, mm-hmm. you know, will complain that they feel like the schools aren't very responsive to their needs.
Right.
But, you know, but the evidence seems to be that they are still tend to be more responsive. That if you're affluent, most likely there's a lot of other high achieving kids in your kid's school. Right. And so they can get served better together. There are other resources, or you have the ability, you know, to pay for a private school or to do stuff after school that yeah. provides that challenge. And the question is, how can we make sure that our schools say, hey, we've got to play that role for these kids who are, again, hugely high potential kids if we can keep challenging them.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think it has to start with recognition. There has to be an acknowledgement that yeah. the student is doing well and it can't be overlooked. I can say without hesitation that what you just said is true, which is that the way that school responds to you when you're the parent of a high achieving student is very different based on class.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'll give you another example from the set of anecdotes that we reported. We have a student in high school who also is at a traditional public high school near New Orleans, but not in it. 11th grader, very strong student, but not except like grades are good, but they're not stratospheric.
Yeah.
The reason that she's always been considered high performing is that she crushes it on tests. So she has the opposite problem that we often hear about with low income kids where they have high grades, but low test scores. She has outstanding test scores. She gets put in accelerated coursework. Sometimes she focuses, sometimes she doesn't. But she's going to graduate in the top 20% of her class and has a chance to have an eye-popping ACT score that probably will open a lot of doors for her.
Yeah.
The average ACT score in her school is a 16.
Wow.
She's probably going to score 25 or 26. When it came time to register for the ACT her junior year, her school takes it as a group during the state testing window. She wanted to take it earlier so she could get more chances at the test and also a chance to get on the radar of colleges.
Mm-hmm.
She needed to get a fee waiver to get the cost of the test waived. To get that, she needed to go to her guidance counselor. Her guidance counselor told her that she couldn't bother with the fee waiver because she was so busy with the 12th graders that were trying to meet graduation requirements that she didn't have 5 minutes to spend filling that out for her.
Yeah.
We thought, you know, everybody has a bad day. Everybody has a busy workload. We'll appeal to the principal. The principal can help us get it sorted out. The principal told us that if the guidance counselor says she doesn't have time for it, she doesn't have time for it. Eventually, we had to get the superintendent of the district to order the principal, to order the guidance counselor to sign a waiver form so one student could get a fee waiver for an ACT.
How much time did that take opposed to the five minutes it would have taken her to just sign it?
I also want you to imagine for a second that could ever in a million years, that type of paperwork issue for a high-performing student who's proactively trying to put herself on the radar of colleges, that would ever happen.
And that every college in the country is saying, we desperately want more kids like this.
So when we say there's undermatching, this is a tiny link in that chain, but these are the sorts of things that seem unbelievable and you think—
Completely believable, actually.
Yeah. So important. And the point being, again, every kid should be a priority, and particularly every low-income kid, and that, of course, we worry a lot about low-income kids who are far behind and they need our help, but low-income kids who are doing well need our help too, because otherwise they're not going to be doing well tomorrow or next year or the year after that.
That's right.
And it's a huge lost opportunity. Tim, thanks so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Are you paying attention to the Caps?
Of course. I watched the game.
Amber is an actual sports fan, unlike me.
Once it gets to the final Stanley Cup thing, you got to tune in for that. So it was great. It was a great game, right?
It's funny. I asked my son Nico about, who's really into this at school, and he was telling me about these various boys, and some of them he describes as well. So and so is just a bandwagon.
And
I'm like,
What are you talking about?
That's totally me. I can't say I'm a huge Capitals fan, but it's exciting for our city.
Well, I bought my godson a Holtby jersey for Christmas last year that was like $120 for a kid's
size.
It was a kid's size version. Youth large.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. By the way,
pro tip, buy the youth size even for adults because they tend to run big, get an adult large.
No, I know. They were very big.
Yeah.
But anyway, a
youth large instead of the adult size? Yeah.
No comment, Mike.
That works for me. Okay.
That was what I remember. But it was not cheap even, but whatever.
And Holtby, you said it probably better than I did.
I don't know if I said it, but I was talking about...
Amber said it right.
Yeah.
All right. But we digress, as we often do. What study do you have for us?
We got a new study forthcoming in the Economics of Education Review called Boosting School Readiness. Should preschool teachers target skills or the whole child? What do you guys think?
Or both. I just want both.
It sounds like...
I taught kindergarten. Both. I want both.
False dichotomy alert.
It's not a false dichotomy.
You can't have both. The study uses experimental data to determine what types of preschool curriculum are most effective in pre-K classrooms that span public preschools, private childcare, and Head Start programs, primarily serving low-income families. The study pulled data from the Preschool Curriculum Evaluation Research Initiative study. I know you guys know that one. Began in 2003 and required evaluations of 14 different early childhood education curricula in preschool centers. Each of the are you guys listening to me? I feel like I'm losing my audience here, people. I'm gonna get to the findings in a second. Just let me get
it
through.
It just sounds familiar for some reason.
Gosh. Familiar. Each of the grantees was responsible for collecting various data for independent evaluations, but this is the first time that somebody came in and looked at all of these evaluations, kind of did like a meta-analysis across these 14 evaluations, comprised of about 2,000 kids. Each grantee randomly assigned. We love this design, right? Randomly assigned whole schools or classrooms within schools to either treatment or control curricula. All right. There were three broad types of curricular assignments. One, the whole child curricula, which is defined as what most Head Start centers use, which uses child-centered active learning, where teachers lead small and large group activities centered around 11 interest areas. So this is like everybody's great idea of when you're a preschool kid. Mm-hmm. You go to the little centers, there's blocks at one, there's dramatic play at another, toys and games, art, music, that kind of stuff. Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's very fun.
That was the business as usual and control condition. The second bucket was locally developed curriculum that is just that, like whatever they're developing locally, that was a second business as usual approach and the second control condition. And last, number three, content-specific curriculum in math or ELA that targeted specific academic skills. That was the treatment.
Okay.
Woo! They did different combos of analysis, such that treatment and control curricula were compared. They also leveraged, just as important, little factoid, they leveraged classroom observation data that examined interactions between teachers and students. Okay? Key finding, the whole child curricula did much better on the process measures for classroom culture, virtually every single one of them, than did the other curricula. Yet, the content-specific curriculum did much better on the academic readiness measures. Mm-hmm. So the Woodcock-Johnson and the Peabody picture test, mm-hmm. those tests that we give little mm-hmm. kids, than did the whole child or the local curricula. For instance, children randomly assigned to the math content curriculum had 0.35 standard deviation higher math and 0.25 standard deviation higher academic composite score, which is obviously mm-hmm. amalgam, at the end of preschool compared to children receiving the curriculum, the creative curriculum, rather. Mm-hmm. That was the whole child thing, okay? Analysts conclude that whole child curriculum should not be mandated, which is apparently what happens in Head Start centers, mm-hmm. Because it doesn't have as much research showing good things. Moreover, they end with this, which I thought was pretty, pretty strong for researchers to say, because you know how sometimes they just want to kind of not give you policy, policy recommendations. In the absence of such evidence, we conclude that policy effects should focus more attention on assessing and implementing developmentally appropriate, proven, skills-focused curricula and move away from the comparatively ineffective whole child approach. And then they end with this, which I don't know, maybe we want to think that's a little harsh, but they end with saying, you know what, by the way, we found no link between these measures of classroom quality and curricular impacts. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you can go in and you can have reviewers that think the teachers are hitting it out of the park in terms of how they're interacting with kids, because that's what we care about. Like mm-hmm. what's the quality of the teacher-student interaction? And it was all these other things around classroom culture, but yet they basically had no relationship, right, to the mm-hmm. academic outcomes that we typically like to see. So they say, you know, don't rely too heavily on these process outcomes mm-hmm. to measure school readiness for kids.
Whew.
Ooh, it's a lot.
That is a lot.
Well, look, it's not surprising that in classrooms where they're not teaching much reading and math, the kids aren't learning much reading and math, right? Even if they're doing all kinds of things and making the kids feel safe and having nice interactions and the like, which mm-hmm. is not to say that they shouldn't do that, right? Mm-hmm, I mean, right. It's just that they should do that and they should teach reading and math.
Right. But can't you learn some of this stuff through these centers?
I yes, mean, you can. Yes, you can.
Can't you learn math through blocks, Alyssa?
Yes, you can. You can also have math centers. Everything through like second grade can be done in centers. Just no one does it.
All right. But it's going to need some guidance too, right? I mean,
my entire day when I was teaching kindergarten was entirely in small group instruction. Yep. And some of it was stuff the kids, you know, I had taught them earlier and it was mm-hmm. them practicing a skill. Some of it was led by my aide. Some of it was direct instruction to me in a small group. Yeah, but
that's right.
They spent max an hour in whole group instruction.
Right, but it doesn't. But it had some direct instruction is all I'm saying. If the goal is to make sure the kid can count to 100, you know, you need to teach them that at some point, right? If they need to know their letters, you need to work on that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, you know, and then they can do the other stuff too. But it does, it reminds me of back in the old days when we used to criticize the National Board for Professional Teaching Standards and saying, you know, the impulse was in many ways very promising, but that they had an idea of what good teaching looked like.
Mm-hmm.
That was just basically what a bunch, you know, what sort of many teachers thought good teaching looked like, but it wasn't validated by whether kids actually learn more
right.
by that way or not. Mm-hmm. And it's that mismatch.
And it felt good, right? And people enjoyed it and kids yeah. enjoyed it and parents liked it. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. So, the performance, it's right. But you know, this radical idea we have, you know, all these right. years later that let's actually pay some attention to whether kids are right. learning or not.
Do they get into it all? And one of the biggest debates right now in pre-K circles and early childhood circles is teacher quality and teacher mm-hmm. certification and teacher education level. So do they get in at all to if there were any variations there or right. like what the average level of
that,
instruction?
That was not a part of this study.
Okay.
Right? No. I mean, what they're using as a proxy for teacher quality is how the teacher is scoring on this classroom observation instrument, right?
Which
and
is
the
super
quality
reliable.
Of their interaction with the kid.
Mm-hmm.
What we're saying is sometimes if a classroom feels all warm and fuzzy, mm-hmm. and the teacher seems very caring and, mm-hmm. you know, the culture seems like what you'd want your kid to be in that type of classroom, that doesn't necessarily mean the teacher is effective.
Yeah.
So.
Boom. Yikes. All right.
Okay.
So bring in the, yeah. yes.
Walk, walk.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hey, well, you know what? I'm about to say this is all the time we have for this week, but before we go.
Yes.
We have to say farewell to
yes.
Alyssa.
Last show. You, thank Alyssa. You guys. I'll miss you too.
Great on the
yes,
podcast.
Yes, indeed.
Been fun.
Alyssa yeah. Schwenk yeah. heading off to Bellwether Education Partners mm-hmm. after taking a little time off to see Europe.
Yeah, that's parts right. of it, not all of it. But yep, I'll be popping back up into education reform after some hiking in Iceland and beaches in Portugal and macaron classes in France at the end of the month.
Nice.
It's a busy vacation.
It does yeah. sound good. Well, maybe someday we'll have you back on the show.
Yes, right.
Always happy to come back and give you some
away.
Guff. Yes.
Keep all our secrets safe.
Oh, my hair is full of secrets.
All right.
All right. Well, that is all the time we've got for this week. Until next week, or not.
I'm Alyssa Schwenk.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.